break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill. This is episode number 73. I'm going to change things up on everybody, but before I do that, I am your host, Michael Feenan. Folks, if you've been enjoying the Drunken UX Podcast, I hope you run by our sponsors over at NewCloud. If you're looking for any kind of interactive mapping or illustration services, you can find them at newcloud.com/drunkenux. Drop in there and let them know that that the beard sent you. Otherwise, if you're looking for us, I encourage you to go track us down on Twitter or Facebook at /drunkenux. If you're on the Instagrams, /drunkenuxpodcast, that will find us in all of those places. Or drop in and chat with us. We are on Discord at drunkenux.com/discord. That'll get you the invite. Do the whole thing. Drop you in the channel. We chat with you. You make fun of us. It's a whole circle of life thing. Folks, I have a little special thing going on tonight. Unfortunately, Aaron cannot be with us, so I thought, what better way to celebrate than to pack the house with some of my best friends in the world? That maybe sounds bad on Aaron, doesn't it? That was not very kind of me. Aaron, we love you, and we expect you back here next week, as a matter of fact. But we had, so this last week, it was High Ed Web, and you've heard me mention this conference many, many times in past episodes. It's a giant conference of people who do marketing, web development, design, UX, accessibility, content strategy, all things web related to higher education, university systems, private schools, international schools.
Keeping your sanity, doing all the things. There are some sessions on that as well.
Yes, indeed. And so I thought, what better way to celebrate? They were doing kind of a neat thing, obviously, because of COVID. So the whole conference was virtual this year. And so I reached out to a few folks and brought them in. Joining me on the other microphones are Paul Gilzow, Matt Ryan, and the illustrious Nikki Mazzaro-Kaufman. And you know what? I'm just going to hand everything over to you guys. I don't want to do the introductions. You folks, tell everybody where you're from, what you do, and how you fit into this wild world of web things.
Go for it, Nikki.
I love my chat. Everybody's pointing at a different box.
Not it.
Nobody's in the same place on each other's screens. Like Paul's just like pointing to space. Paul, tell us all about you're the one everybody's familiar with probably because I've had you on the show before. So that's only fair that I make you go first.
All right, that'll work. So Paul Gilzow at the University of Missouri. I'm a programmer analyst. I'm in charge of the along with a colleague. Building, designing, and maintaining the web infrastructure that we have for all of our sites. And then I'm the lead WordPress architect for our campus.
So I'm Nikki Mazzaro-Kaufman. I work for Penn State University. And I work as a programmer analyst. And my current position, I am doing development for the College of Arts and Architecture's Office of Digital Learning.
I'm Matt Ryan. I also work at Penn State. I work for outreach and online education. I am the UI/UX designer for that group for the web strategy group. And that's sort of what it says on the tin. I do UI and UX work both. Do quite a bit of both sort of the soup to nuts of user research to fiddly design work.
Okay, so Nikki, I'm going to start with you because while Paul's been on the show before, we've had a colleague of yours on. Brian Olendike joined us, I think it was partway through season 2. I may be fudging my brain on that because I don't know these things nearly as well as Aaron does. But Brian was on, he's one of the main brains behind the Hacks CMS and Hacks Editor, which is a web component centric approach to kind of like what Gutenberg is doing, but with an eye towards, you know, no dependencies on any platform, accessibility front and center, and built entirely on open standards that make it very flexible, very portable, and all of these things. So let me start there in terms of what have you been doing with web components of late? Because I know that you have gotten steeped into that world recently.
Yeah, so what I have mostly finished, but I, you know, there's always things we can do to improve, is the A11Y dash media player, or dash media dash player. It's a media player that is built for accessibility for our online courses, but could be used for other purposes. And everything about it is built from web components, which means that it can be used anywhere. You just include the JavaScript and use the tag and you've got it. It uses progressive enhancement. So if you don't have the JavaScript, it's just going to show up, you know, you're using a video tag in the middle or a YouTube iframe or an audio tag. And so that will be, that's integrated within our Hacks block editor project, the Hacks CMS, which is an entire CMS built around Hacks, Hacks 110, which is the Hacks CMS plus 110. And we have Elms LN, which is a Drupal-based learning management system that students authenticate into. And that also has Hacks in the video player. And we have another project that I've been working on this year. It's a redesign for our virtual studio, because I'm working with arts courses. And how do you submit your work online for an arts course? How do you critique it? How do you encourage students to provide feedback? And we do that with a version of the studio that Brian had to put together in 2 weeks' time at one point. And now that we've gotten past some of the COVID rush, we are, you know, I have some breathing space to look at what we want to do with that. And that front end will be entirely web components based. It's going to sit as the front end to our Drupal-based systems. But if we someday want to migrate off of Drupal, it just needs, you know, in the HTML tag, it just needs attributes for the data sources. And then it will just build the interface from there.
Let me ask a quick question about that video player, too. Is that something that you guys wrote from scratch, or is that, like, I'm familiar with tools like Able Player that are very, like, accessibility forward media players. Is it built on top of that, or is it something you developed? What's the sort of nature of that player?
I'm going to call it Able Player inspired, in that, you know, for our needs, there was a point where Able Player was the only thing that could meet that. But I wanted something that was more componentized so that I could style it and theme it a little bit more flexibly. And so there are some features that I don't have in it yet that Able Player does, but it was definitely inspired by the Able Player work. It's kind of like if the YouTube player and Able Player had a decent looking baby.
Let me go, Paul and Matt, to you guys. Same kind of question, but from a slightly different angle. Is anything, especially Paul, I know with the WordPress rollout you guys have been working on, and how that applies to things like, you know, what you're going to do with Gutenberg, or about Gutenberg as the case may be, any web component stuff flowing through any of that work, or is it something you're trying to avoid entirely right now?
So if you remember, maybe a couple of years ago, I talked about that dream system where we would have a design system, and as we built design system components, they'd flow into both WordPress and Drupal. We've actually got that at a alpha stage now, to almost a beta stage, where our systems now actually can consume the design system. So as my colleague who's in charge of the design system updates things, he can push those out. Then I update from his system, pull those down, and it flows out to our base theme, is what we call it. And those design system components are immediately available in all the sites as soon as they update. So that's kind of the first stage. The next stage that we want to reach is to start swapping out some of those with web components. You mentioned Gutenberg. We actually haven't gone to Gutenberg still. The initial hesitation was the accessibility of it. It's better now. I think from WP Campus, I forgot the speaker that talked about it, they're at about 66% completion of the different issues that were raised. The challenge, though, being that as they fix issues, Gutenberg is progressing along, so more issues are created. And so they're kind of at this state of never quite reaching completion. And so one of the things we've discussed is taking the Hacks CMS layer, that piece, and putting it on top of WordPress and Drupal instead of Gutenberg, and using that and flowing that through. The challenge in either direction.
If it makes you feel any better, we're talking about the same thing, but not with, we don't use WordPress, we use a different CMS, but we're discussing basically the exact same thing.
The challenge, the hesitation so far is one, we just don't have the resources to move as fast as we would like to do, or like to go. And the other is simply retraining content people in a new interface and how that works, because they're so used to the old interfaces.
More than, you know, any technical or logistical complaints about Gutenberg or, you know, the accessibility and whatnot, just getting people used to it, especially when they have been used to the old style editing process, even if it's not WordPress, that old sort of WYSIWYG approach to content editing has been so ingrained in a lot of people that the change is such a culture shock kind of thing to them. I can handle it fine because I understand the transition, you know, what a block is and how to think in them. But a lot of people who aren't technical folks who get put in charge of content, bridging that gap is such a huge leap for them. Matt, what about what's going on then in your outreach group? Are you guys then plugged right into then the work that Nikki and Brian are doing with Hacks? Or are you in a whole other silo unto yourself?
We really are in a very different silo. Penn State's a big place and there's a lot of different groups. You know, unfortunately, Nikki and I have had few opportunities to work together. We've, you know, sort of kept in touch, but I wouldn't say that we've necessarily had more of an opportunity than before when I joined Penn State. And some of that is perhaps due to COVID eating at least large quantities of my time. I don't know about you, Nikki, if it's eaten a big chunk of your work too.
Oh yeah. Less so than the people who are instructional designers who are on the front lines when faculty say, put this stuff online. But there are definitely effects. You know, people want this new studio redesign. People who didn't have arts courses online from the beginning. And we had issues where when people first went online, we had, you know, systems were running slower, but the web components were so fast that there was sort of a disconnect between the components that we were working with. So we had to do a little bit of refactoring. So for instance, the A11Y media player, was using the YouTube API, but I hadn't thought of the way I was doing it didn't account for a YouTube delay in rendering that initial iframe.
Yeah. So last year in 2019, I did a presentation on some usability work we did with Gutenberg. And this is something that I think what you're talking about is really a piece that a lot of us who are kind of already pre-familiar with many of the concepts behind Gutenberg don't really recognize the extent to which Gutenberg represents you have to have a completely different mental model for how you interact with your web content to use a tool like Gutenberg. And that for folks who are familiar with sort of classic WYSIWYG style editors, the learning curve is much steeper, I think, than many people recognize. And we saw that. Some of the big challenges had to do with just this fundamental idea of thinking of things as blocks. That took a lot more for people to sort of actually sort of get their heads around that. And Gutenberg it sort of through its design obscures many of those sort of fundamental bones of it in its desire to also be WYSIWYG as well as structured. It hides the structure to make it look like the page.
Yeah.
All of the discoverability is through mouse over and things like that. And so many of the affordances and many of the sort of visual cues that might help you understand the structure of the thing you're working with and might help you like understand that you have these blocks to work with are sort of subordinated in the interface. And I think if Gutenberg had a learner mode where it was not so WYSIWYG and where like there was much more sort of signposting and much more sort of omnipresent user interface elements, it would really like make that learning curve much softer for users. Then people could turn it off once they're like, you know, I've got this, I want sort of this more WYSIWYG mode. But it's sort of like, at least the way it's currently designed, I ended up creating a WordPress plugin that just uses CSS to kind of at least provide some visual, some more visual cues about what's going on.
I'm immediately reminded of the jQuery plugin. I think Joyride is the one I'm thinking of, where it just lets you like mark certain things on a page or whatnot, and it'll do pop-ups and, you know, take you on that when you go into like a new product or something, and it does like the product tour or what have you. Something like that, I could see, you know, walking you through the Gutenberg editor. And
yeah, and Gutenberg does have a tour, but in our user research, no one ever used it. So that didn't help all that much. Its existence didn't help. it really needed more just sort of like always there interface changes. You know, I think going through a tour would have helped people a lot, but you know, we were and training obviously helps, but we were sort of wanting to get at that raw usability of the untrained user and to see what they would do. Would they take the tour? They didn't take the tour.
So, yeah, that's an easy one. I don't need a lot of research to tell you they don't read. Don't check. Let's go. So as we talk, obviously COVID-19 has changed everybody's work approach and schedule and location and all of this. And I think in higher ed in particular, the number of fires that have sort of been thrown into your laps with regard to not just the strictly technical, but Nikki, like you were saying, you know, adapting the LMS to accept all of this content and all of these tools and features that kids need to make and have access to. Let's start with the easy part, which is where have you guys found success in terms of adapting, you know, whether that's your workflows, your tools, anything. I'm leaving this table wide open in terms of what you consider success, if that's code you've written or how you write the code, so to speak.
So that's an interesting question, because one of the things that that my coworker Brian has been working on is improving the performance of the systems that we're using, and we are now heavily leveraging dynamic imports, and. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in typical JavaScript framework land, you're bundling up everything you could possibly use plus your framework and loading that the first time a new user goes to your very first page. Where what we're doing with this dynamic importing technique is that we have a CDN of web components and all their dependencies, and there's none of the scripts really load other than this script that watches for which components are on the page. And then loads any definitions that aren't already cached. So you're only getting for each page the definitions that you have that you need that you don't already have. And we've seen a lot of performance increases or performance enhancements from that. And anecdotally, Ryan was also teaching an information sciences and technology course when COVID hit. And so some of the international students had to go back home. One of his students contacted him and said, it's great that your content has been on this Hack CMS thing that you're working on, because I can't, the third party LMS that we're using, learning management system, is a React based monolith. And from India, he was unable to access it, but he could get our course content. And that's the sad part is, you know, there's always that build versus buy. But a lot of the built products are using frameworks. And what we wanted to be able to have open educational resources, OER content, you know, we have open source tools. We want to open source the course content, drive down the cost of textbooks. And so we had built a lot of these systems so that we could author a lot of content at scale and be able to share it across. We have 20 departments and 20 some campuses across the state. And so to be able to share somebody teaching, you know, a basic music course at our campus, we want to be able to share once COVID hit with the people that might be at a branch campus who teach a music course and all of a sudden put this stuff online. And with these monolith third-party systems, there was no way to extract and remix that content because faculty all like to teach a little differently. I always talk about teaching as it's a lot like wearing somebody else's clothes when you're taking someone else's content. It's not exactly your style. And OER is remixable, so it's like going thrifting to put together your course.
The thing I'll take a second to point out to folks too, if you've listened to the show a couple episodes back, we had Chris Ferdinandi on. He's a huge Vanilla.js advocate, and one of the reasons for that is, Nikki, what you're talking about, which is performance. The performance you can get from just a page of HTML and a little bit of normal JavaScript is light years ahead of even a very simple React app, and how long that can take to load and render for the user, especially international users. To the thing about web components, if anybody wants to look at this, I'll throw a link to some of the stuff Brian's been sharing, that he's basically written up this very cool little loader. Web components, if you haven't used them, they're custom HTML elements, but you need a little bit of JavaScript to tell the browser what to do with that element. So there's this, let's call it a definition file, for lack of a better term, that you have to load. Normally, you would throw that in a build process and, like you're saying, Nikki, mash them together into this giant file that everybody downloads. Brian, in his big brain thinking, went out and figured out that he can write a very small piece of JavaScript that figures out which specific files it needs to do that and only downloads those on demand to speed up the rendering of the page. It's freaking brilliant. So I'll throw some links to that because I think that's very much worth sharing and making sure that people have some insight into.
There was a tweet heard around the high ed community about web performance a couple weeks ago. And it was related, it was a New York Times piece about students during the pandemic and the fact that there were students that, not that I know of locally, but students who were going without groceries because their cellular data cost of having to take classes from home during the pandemic were, you know, too much for them to be able to do and keep themselves fed. And I think that underscores, you know, universities always have, you know, really great internet access when you're on campus, in the same way that Silicon Valley has really great internet access. But when you're talking about anywhere outside of that, lots of rural areas, leave the United States, all of a sudden bandwidth becomes a big issue.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the focus has been on performance, and performance is important from a UX perspective, but once you're talking about data caps and once you're talking about, you know, people on spotty connections, you know, the actual quantity of data then becomes, and, you know, the number of round trips and other things that aren't necessarily performance per se, you know, maybe it's all stuff that's happening after the, you know, your first contentful pane or whatever, but like, it's still charging against your data plan.
Have you noticed anything, Paul, with regards, like, you're going towards this sort of systemized approach to websites? Have you done any research or looking into like the performance impacts of, or benefits rather, of having sort of that shared design system across multiple sites?
Oh yeah, I don't know if we've done necessarily research, but we definitely can show a number of FTE hours saved by doing this. In fact, you're asking about successes. One of the successes that we've seen, one thing that we've tried to sell administration for years is, if we can stop treating every website request as a special snowflake, instead take that time that we would spend on it and build common features, common wants and needs, we can get to the point where we can churn out sites really, really fast. You know, if we have the stomach to tell people, you want a site, I get that. You're going to get 80% of your needs met. You'll get another 10%. We'll fudge it, right? We'll figure out that other 10%, but you're going to have to compromise on that last 10, and you're not going to get any of your wants right now. But we actually finally got to do that. We were able to spend a big chunk of the summer building out functionality in these base themes that meet 80% of the needs. And we were able to in the later times, as we started going back to class, and we had people coming and saying, we need a site within a week. Well, in the past, that would have been unheard of. There's no way we could have gone through the process of figuring out what they want, build all the custom stuff, give them a site. And in this case, we were able to start churning out sites in less than a week and giving them 80% of what they need right out the door. And then fudging that last little 10%, but then taking even that fudge and going back and saying, okay, what do we need to adjust in these base themes to build out more of these needs or build out that functionality these people need? So now we're able to churn really, really quickly, especially because we're losing more and more of our own resources.
Are you using anything on that end? Because a design system is a big thing. Design systems include design philosophies and branding standards and all of this stuff. But just from like the web end, the useful piece that a lot of web people will touch is that pattern library piece of it. Are you utilizing anything like either Fractal or Astrum or Pattern Lab? Or
he's using Fractal. Yeah, he uses Fractal to build it.
I'm glad to hear that, because that's the one I've chosen for a project, so that makes me feel better about
it. It was on Pattern Lab, and then something didn't work with Pattern Lab, and then he shifted to Fractal, and I know that's what he's on now.
Yeah, Fractal's a neat tool that lets you build in all these little examples of your code and showcase them in abstract. So if you just want to see what your buttons look like, here's what your buttons look like. And here are your variations on those buttons, so that when somebody says, the way I like to talk about it is go shopping. You need to build your site. Here you go. Go shopping. Pick your blocks. Pick your, you know, your content sections. Pick your buttons. Some buttons come with the content sections, so be, you know, and we'll have those mocked up there. But it really, a storybook is another one. I think, Nikki, you may be a little familiar with storybook, because I think, doesn't it ship with libhtml, I think?
It is.
Or OpenWC. OpenWC.
The OpenWC has their own implementation of storybook specifically for web components. Before they had that, I struggle to get storybook up and running. And then anytime something little changes.
It's very dense.
It was, yeah. And
it's a very dense tool, but it's very cool. The thing storybook has over something like Fractal to me is it has all these dials and tweaks. Like you can not only like define like different variants of a thing, but you can code in all the little checkboxes and stuff to set different things for like real time in the display. So you want to see it disabled on a small screen on mouse over, and you can check those boxes. Or if you want to change the width of its container element, you can make that a variable that can be resized. It's very cool. I think if you're really into QA, I think is where somebody would really geek out about that, because you can write integration tests that literally use Storybook, change all these variables in real time, you know, take the screenshot and see if all your stuff still looks the way it's supposed to look. But yeah, not easy to get there from my experience. Yeah.
It's very nice once you do. We have a lot of so that web form with all of the controls, basically they call that a knobs, and they control slots within web components, which is just the inside of a web component and the attributes on the tag and properties. But you can play around with those within those fields, and then that would, you know, update the component. And we've added pieces that give you the code snippet that you can just easily copy, so that once you've tweaked that within our instance, webcomponents.psu.edu, if you play around with our components and you play around with those knobs, you'll get a customized version of that that you can just copy and paste. On the developer end of it, I started writing a set of scripts that allow me to write these stories a lot faster and to add sort of a randomization element. It's some of these, I call them lorem data tools. And so it throws in, right now it's just using the TV series community So there's a lot of community quotes in some of the random stuff that shows up, but it'll give random accent colors, random numbers, random icons. And that helps us see how things look too.
And Matt, what about from your end, being apart from some of this, this web component hacks craziness, what have you guys found success with in terms of the outreach and the work that you're doing?
Well, just personally, you know, one of the things that has been a big part of this year for me has been I came from a place where I was very, you know, I had become a jack of all trades. And so I was just personally stretched incredibly thin. I was doing everything from, back-end development to, you know, I was putting together our pattern library, in Pattern Lab. I was doing UX and design work. I was doing, you know, I was the accessibility expert. I was the everything in my previous role. And, I'm now able to focus on the part of my work that is sort of my strength. And so, that's personally been incredibly gratifying, and enabled me to do some things which I've wanted to do, you know, for forever, it seems like. One of the things that I'm currently working on is a pretty large scale top tasks survey, because none's ever really been done that I'm aware of. There's other kinds of surveys that get at sort of measuring the temperature and of our this is sort of thinking particularly about our prospective students, but we've never really done one that's aimed at getting a really solid quantitative sense of, you know, what's most important to prospective students when they're visiting our site. And so, you know, that's going to be, I think, a really great foundation moving forward. That's, you know, it's still in progress. We haven't launched the survey yet, but just, you know, being able to work on that, being able to work on it with a really solid marketing research team, who's able to, you know, sort of take it to another level than I would have been able to do all by myself, has been really great. So that's been something that just personally is really thrilling to work on stuff like that.
And probably helps reduce stress greatly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's not all on me to, you know, to make that right decision when there are other people in the room who, you know, probably have more expertise about, you know, certain aspects. And where I don't have to always be the expert about everything.
Yeah. So we talked about the easy part. The easy part is dealing with the successes, because it's easy to know, and much more comfortable, to deal with what we do well. What has posed the biggest challenge for you all right now in terms of making these changes and adaptations and all of that to whether it's COVID, whether it's shrinking budgets, whether it's changes, you know, just in your personnel, you know, whatever the case may be, where have you found some of those struggles in terms of this year?
I think this year, the biggest thing is everybody wants something and everybody wants it now and has to have it now. The core group of developers for all of the things I've described, Hacks, the studio, Elmzellen, the Drupal-based content system, Hack CMS, all of that, and the beauty of Web Components is that we've been doing all of that with a core team of 4 developers. But that also means now that everybody wants us to work on all of them now, what we're really interested in is having contributors. And you know, we've been talking about how we're doing this so that we can benefit all of higher ed, and it's componentized so people can adopt, you know, maybe they just adopt the player and they don't want to adopt anything else because they want to figure out this whole web components universe. Maybe they just want the Hacks block editor. Maybe they go all the way to the CMS and everything else that we build. But, you know, we could do so much more as people become aware that this is here. And there are so many levels to contribute, whether that's to the documentation or just submitting an issue in the issue queue. We have a developer in France that is doing some accessibility and internationalization stuff for us. And we welcome that. I really love it when people tell me my work needs to be fixed, because that means it's going to get better. It would be like me walking around with something in my teeth and nobody telling me. So I know people can be really touchy about getting feedback and critiques, but the Elms LN community loves contributions.
And it's worth pointing out that if you're listening to this on release day, there are still a few days left in Hacktoberfest. I'm just going to throw that out there. There's still time if you are looking for a project to go make some PRs to. Maybe Hacks is one of those little things that you find a niche in.
Yeah, and it's a friendly community. I mean, I am, you know, an over 40 female type. And, you know, I know people talk about toxic developer communities. This is the farthest you could be from toxic. So it's a place where if you're new or if you're not sure if you're welcome, you belong with us. Trust me.
And the thing that I'll kind of vouch for is knowing Nikki, knowing Brian certainly better now than I did before. You know, these are people who are also educators. And so to say that, you know, they are in this to help people learn, and even if they're not teaching in a classroom necessarily, it's still no different from anywhere else. And so if you want to learn, if you're looking for that area, I would definitely argue that that is a great place to get started. Go read some documentation, go look at what they're doing, and you may surprise yourself.
We're sort of having a Halloween party next week on Friday in the Elms LN Slack space that anyone is welcome to join. We put out an invitation to a Zoom call, and we call it an uncode review. Basically, it's anybody can bring up a topic, whether it's something they want to show off or if they have questions, even the most basic questions related to our projects and web components, we're happy to answer. We get such a variety of people. So if that's something that somebody really wants to, you know, try something new, you know, join us for our big Halloween party.
I stress frequently how important mentorship is in our industry, and, you know, how that's how we get better. That's how all of us improve on things. And, you know, here I am, I'm very near 40. And that's something every time I jump into new JavaScript and stuff, it's like, who can show me what I'm trying to do here? Because I know I'm in over my head.
I just presented and on web components in a 10-minute talk and got a lot of interest in it. And one person was, you know, reached out to me and said, well, how do I get started? And this has happened a couple of times, but it made me write a getting started article from the very beginning. Like, just, I'm not even a developer. I just want to, you know, play with your stuff with HTML code. And I went back and I told that person, yeah, thank you, because this, your question makes it better. Even the fact that you asked a question.
And Matt, what's in your area, where are you hitting the biggest sort of roadblocks or speed bumps in terms of, especially like from the UX side? We don't, being the Drunken UX podcast, we should probably talk about UX much more than we do as a specific topic, but you know, is, I can imagine, and I'm gonna throw a pitch out to you and see how it goes. But you know, how even does user experience research work in the world of everybody being remote and not being able to bring people into your, you know, into your labs or into your spaces so that you can look over their shoulder and watch them interact with things?
I've actually been having to figure this out. Previously, I had been doing most of my research in person and oftentimes very guerrilla style, just, you know, like sitting at a table in, you know, the student union or sitting at, you know, sort of grabbing prospective students in the admissions office. I'd say the biggest challenge has been recruitment with in person, particularly with students. It's very easy to recruit using pizza, but that doesn't work online. So sort of recruitment efforts have had to be a lot more formal. The actual, you know, doing of the, you know, if you're doing just a standard usability study, it's not really that different. Just using any screen sharing software seems to work really great, actually, for, observing users. There's maybe if we were trying to do something that was a little bit more contextual analysis, where we're like wanting to see their workspace and that sort of thing, that would probably be a little more challenging. Typically, in previous life, I'd been used to being able just to go into people's offices. In terms of challenges, other kinds of challenges, one of the big challenges has been, I've been part of a group. The big part of our work typically in our group is supporting Penn State World Campus, which has not been dramatically impacted by COVID. But there's two things that have really changed. One is that some of the research that we want to do that's sort of more about attitudes is very hard to do right now because we don't know. We can't necessarily bank on anything we come out of that kind of research continuing to hold true for any period of time. You know, it's so particular to this moment.
Right.
And so that's really challenging. And there's actually a fair amount of qualitative research that we've just put on the shelf, that we've just tried to figure out other ways to do it. And in fact, this top task research is part of the reason why we're focusing on that right now, is because it felt like a kind of more structured kind of research that we felt like we could still get some really useful and hopefully more like durable insights. The other thing is that our group has been tasked with maintaining the continuity of learning and continuity of teaching sites for Penn State. And that's been a much like larger amount of work than I think we had anticipated, the pandemic being a larger thing than most people anticipated at the beginning, of course. But one of the real challenges has been when we enter a new realm, we oftentimes don't apply the expertise that we already have, we've already built up in other realms to that new realm. We sort of act like an absolute beginner, and we don't sort of transfer those skills over. And I think that's true for institutions too. You know, institutions that maybe have built up good governance and good sort of processes for their sort of their operationalized web work for in this crisis communication, in this like extremely long-term crisis communication situation that we've been in, a lot of that has you know, it's sort of like, it's like that stuff doesn't exist. And we are kind of back at square one of governance and process. And so, you know, we're in that situation that you never want to be in, where there's umpteen different stakeholders all just sort of pelting you with things that you didn't know were going to show up and it needs to go on the website the next day. And I think probably a lot of people at a lot of institutions are in that situation with the right process and with the right sort of governance in place. You know, it could have been a different story. And so, you know, we've been trying to sort of make our silk purses out of our sow's ears.
It adds a lot of weight to what Paul was saying, I think, in the success that they've found getting their design system rolled in as a, you know, a function of the way they are starting to do development now, so that when those requests come in, like you were just saying, you know, they don't have to reinvent things over and over. They have found an enormous amount of efficiency by being able to, you know, componentize and systemize their development and their themes such that somebody asks for something, now they can be much more nimble and meet that 80% threshold. We use that same kind of vernacular at work as well. This let's get that easy 80%, you know, the 80-20 rule. We'll pursue the other 20% when that value makes sense. But not force ourselves to keep fighting, you know, fighting back against this need to make everything custom or everything new every single time.
I think Matt hit the nail on the head with the, transferring that old knowledge to a new situation. And, you know, because I'm working in the, you know, after somebody's actually decided to go here and has opted to go online, our courses have been designed from the get-go to be online. So the typical pre-COVID process for taking a course and saying, here's my course, I'm going to start working on it, and I'm going to put it online, takes a couple of semesters to actually happen. And that's because there's, you know, instructional media that's involved. There's thinking about how that transfers to an online space. There's a lot of planning that goes into that. And then I really feel for all the educators who had to up and do this. So there's going to be a difference. There's a whole generation of people who are going to think online learning is something different because what they got is the TV dinner version. And what we usually do is prepare a 5-course meal. So there's a big difference between the courses that are offered. And a lot of people don't know how to transfer that skill. And you see a great variety. A lot of people think it's just putting up PowerPoints or putting up 40-minute videos, which is a really bad user experience. And, you know, part of the reason that we got into this, the block editing and the authoring that we're doing is because a lot of course content management systems that are out of the box assume a face-to-face environment where you're just uploading your slides and that's it, and maybe taking a couple of tests. It doesn't allow for that media-rich, interactive lab and simulation environment where, you know, one activity is this, you get some information, and then you try it out. It's not, a lot of online LMSs that are offered to people are not built for the ideal way to learn online. And so we built the block editor for that reason. So what you're getting, the best is yet to come. You know, as people start to figure out that this stuff's available and this is how we're going to have to learn.
A lot of opportunity in all of the frustration and all the inconvenience. And even Nikki's cat agrees with me on that sentiment. Let me close this out on sort of a side discussion here. I'm curious to know, as this year has gone on and, you know, you've worked remotely or, you know, worked within collaborative environments in different ways, you know, whether that's approaching Matt, the testing side of UX or Nikki, you know, developing and testing web components and things like this, what tools have you found? And I'm not talking like just Zoom, you know, everybody has to use Zoom or Hangouts or something or Slack, but like, with regards to the actual web side of things, what are the tools that you are finding either newfound appreciation for or just new, you know, new stuff that you didn't have in your tool chest before to help you accomplish what you're working on now?
Yeah, for me, there are some, sort of came in and there wasn't a strong existing library of, you know, pre-built design components in any design tool. There was a bunch of Illustrator files. And so, you know, it was sort of like, well, you know, pick what, you know, what UX design tool you want to use. And so I got, you know, it was kind of a fun chance to just play around with some various options. I'd already been using Sketch a lot and, you know, I got to play around with Figma, mm-hmm. which I like. In the end, so far I've settled on XD. Just because it's something that I can, you know, I can transfer with colleagues a little more easily, within my setting. You know, that's just been kind of a fun process to play around with those tools. And there's definitely things that XD is still pretty rough around the edges. But it has some very like powerful stuff going on. And so I'm appreciated that the things about it that are there to appreciate, also have been able to dive a lot more into Optimal Workshops offerings. And so that's been, you know, it's been good to just sort of more broadly use some of their tools. Recently did a bunch of tree testing and also helped WP Campus a little bit with some card sorting and tree testing work they were doing for their website redesign, which was fun.
And I'll attest to the XD component of that. If anybody is interested in wireframing, prototyping, you know, design language type tools, the beautiful thing about XD is if you already have Photoshop or I actually got the creative suite for the photography deal, you get XD for free. It's just included with your subscription. And so a lot of it's one of those things that if you don't know it's there, go look, because you just get it. And it's easily available. We are a Figma shop at work now, so that's I use XD for my personal stuff, but then Figma is where we land for all of our work stuff, but has been very useful, irrespective of which one.
Yeah, I found Figma to be really fun to use. We used it for the WP campus redesign, and just being able to sit with, you know, two other designers on a call and simultaneously, you know, move things around and throw together wireframes and stuff like that was really fun.
You know, the silly thing about Figma that I kind of like is, because I'm not a user of it in the designer sense. I'm a consumer of what our designers make, so I read it to make the stuff in HTML. When we're all in there, you can see everybody's cursors moving around.
It's silly.
But it makes me laugh.
The thing, if I have a big gripe about XD, it's the typography and type handling, which I'm so shocked about, because this is Adobe. Like, I would think they could just, you know, just pull that stuff in from, like, just pick one of their other products, right? But they're, you know, you cannot, for example, in a single text block, you cannot apply different text styles to that block. You cannot apply different line heights, even though you can apply different font sizes. And so, you know, there's just this, like, it just feels like this incredibly crude aspect of the software. I'm hoping they're working on it.
Well, one of the things that I really miss is a lot of times the people who are local to my team would just meet at a local Starbucks on campus sometimes, because we were, you know, two of us are in the arts college, then two of us are in the College of Science. And, you know, eventually we were picking up some other people because Brian teaches courses. There are students who get really interested in the project and the ethics behind it. And I call them Brian's disciples, that would stop by people from other departments that were curious. And it's, you know, so you could do some sort of like shared coding environment. And it wasn't until the pandemic that I really used the live share feature on VS Code. And yeah. I've been using that to, sometimes I'll block off my time to get some other people on campus who want to start contributing sort of up to speed. It's nice to have that, you know, one-on-one talk. I could let them drive, but still have the ability to step in if needed.
If you don't use VS Code, Atom has a similar feature called Teletype. So if you haven't converted, I'm a VS Code convert now. I was totally Atom up until earlier this year, but VS Code stole me. So I can appreciate that, but there is a similar feature both ways that as part of like a swarm for our team, because we had been playing with a lot of this, and if anything, we've taken that opportunity to kind of refine, I think, some of our interactions and relationships. And anything else that either of you would like to add to this discussion before we get out of here?
Well, that's reminding me I'm still looking for a good tool. I heard mentioned at HyadWeb Miro as one, sort of a digital whiteboarding collaborative tool. But, you know, if either of you or anyone else has any good suggestions for that, that's something that particularly given the fact that I'm a remote employee for the long term. So, you know, I'm going to need something like that. A big part of my design process is collaborative sketching, whiteboard work. And so, you know, it's something that I've been able to work around to some extent, but I do feel that pain of not having that.
The one that I have used, I've used Miro, whiteboard.fi. Now, it's been a long time since I've used it, so I can't necessarily speak to how it is now, but it was useful, I think, probably 2 years ago was the last time I used it. So that may be one worth looking into and just see kind of what it's like in this day and age. I'll throw links to those in the show notes. And yeah, and if any of the listeners have suggestions, by all means, throw them at us, throw them in the comments on the show notes, or hit us on Twitter or any of those places. I'd be happy to hear. And not just on whiteboards, but anything, any of the tools you're using, any of the resources that have come in handy.
So I've been using, because I don't have my big whiteboard, I bought myself a whiteboard note or a dry erase notebook. Because I had tried before, you know, when the pandemic first hit, with just a bunch of note papers. And I, as you've noticed, I have desk cats and they don't like my stacks of paper. But this wonderful dry erased notebook has been a way that I don't have to convert a bunch of my wall space to whiteboard, and I can, you know, still whiteboard ideas.
Folks, kick back, stay with us for one more minute and we will get you right back on to your next show.
The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux.
I hope this was helpful to you. Nikki, Paul, Matt, A, thanks for taking time out of your evening to sit down. I know you're all coming in hot out of High Ed Web and the amount of work and time and effort that go into running and speaking and doing all of those things. So I appreciate to the end of the earth, the flat earth and back, you taking that time to spend with us this evening. Paul, unfortunately, did have to cut out a little bit early on us. If you want to find him, he's at Gilzow on Twitter. He is a ridiculously brilliant mind, and he will be too humble to ever admit it, but he's a Red Stapler winner at High Ed Web. He's done some of the best talks I've ever heard, and is a smart, smart dude. So if you have a chance to connect with him, I highly recommend it. But Nikki, Matt, I'm going to turn it over to you. Take the microphone for a few minutes. Tell folks where they can find you, what you got going on, and anything else that you want them to know.
Well, thanks, everyone. I'm at mryand, M-R-Y-A-N-D on Twitter. And that's probably the best way to get in touch with me. Yeah, happy to talk about any of these topics or anything else.
And I'm Nikki Massaro-Kaufman. You can get me at NikkiMK on Twitter. That's also how you can get to me, NikkiMK@psu.edu, although I also have the Penn State alias EvilGenius@psu.edu. So if you're feeling like you want to send in a very fun way, you can catch me that way. And our project, hacktheweb.org, has some more details on how you can get involved with our work. And don't forget the ElmsLN Slack, elmsLNSlack.com.
We'll have links to all of those and more in the show notes. If you want to get a hold of us, we're easy to find. Twitter or Facebook, /DrunkenUX. Instagram is /DrunkenUXPodcast. If you want to join us on Discord, drunkenux.com/Discord. I hope everybody found a little bit of usefulness in this and learned a little something and took away some nuggets. There's a favorite piece of advice that Doug always gives at High Ed Web, which is you're going to learn a lot. You're going to hear a lot of stories. You're going to hear a lot of talks that give you a wealth of information. And all you need to worry about is find the one thing that was valuable and apply that one thing. And if you can do that, then all of the learning was worthwhile. And I'm going to say that about this episode. Go back, listen through it, find the one thing that was useful, valuable, that can help you out, and either apply it or ask us a question about it or do whatever it takes. Because when it comes to building good websites, whether it doesn't matter if you're in higher ed, it doesn't matter if you're in accounting or hospitality or healthcare or any of those industries, the biggest piece of advice that matters is that you keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye-bye.